I have some quite strange songs in my record collection, and I thought I might just quote the lyrics of one of them to you now. It's by Janis Joplin, and it starts like this. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches, I must make amends. I've worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? Now, I'd like to think that she possibly had her tongue in firmly in her cheek when she wrote those words. And perhaps we can give her some marks for being honest about what she felt. But theologically, frankly, she gets 0 out of 10. I'm fairly sure that however hard you pray, you shouldn't expect God to provide you with a flashy new motor car. But actually, she is onto something, isn't she? It is a common trap of envying what others have, what we perceive their life to be like, that most of us fall into from time to time. And it's not just something that affects us and our generation. It's been part of what humanity has been like for an awful long time. In fact, it's reflected in the first half of the psalm which we heard read earlier. Think about verse 3, and indeed the second half of verse 12, when the psalmist is wishing that he had the same luxurious lifestyle that he sees people who he doesn't consider to be as godly as him to have. Do we fall into that trap sometimes? Do we think about what we see other people having, or maybe even what we assume that they must have, and get jealous? Do we watch luxurious lifestyles on television and wish that it was us? Frankly, sometimes we walk through the church car park and think, that looks nice, I wish that was mine. It affects all of us from time to time. Some of you will know that I'm going to move house in a few weeks' time. And on Friday, we were looking around the new property, and I'm standing in the kitchen, which was perfectly fine, a very nice kitchen, and I couldn't help thinking, yeah, but it's not as big as the one that we've got at the moment. I forgot that actually all the houses that I've lived in for the last 20-odd years have been substantially larger than the one that my parents lived in for the whole of their married life. I forgot that I am part of the privileged few on this planet who have enough, and that at least 2/3 of the rest of the world don't worry about exactly how big their kitchen is, but have more important things to worry about. So it's natural, but it's not healthy to envy what we see others having as their possessions. But the psalmist describes more than that. In verse 4 and the first half of verse 12, he talks about having a life with no struggles, and he assumes that those he sees who have more than him, even if they're not very godly, don't have any worries at all. Now, don't get me wrong. I believe that there are people who struggle in this life and that those struggles are real. If that wasn't the case, we wouldn't be running a food bank from this church, for example. And yet, struggles don't define us. The lack of struggles for those who we think deserve them, or struggles that we might have even though we're sure we don't, actually they're less important than the attitude that we have. And regularly, as I speak to people who I think have many more struggles than I do, I am amazed by just how positive their mindset is, how they don't necessarily consider themselves worse off, how they're coping with things that I'm not sure that I could cope with. It's easy to sit there and think, why has that person got no struggles when I have? But actually, it's far from the most important question we can ask. Because it leads us down a very dangerous road. And we see that in verse 14 of the psalm, when the psalmist asks, why don't God reward his own? Why, if I'm one of the godly people, aren't I getting more than everybody else? And one step further down that path is asking the question, is following God worth the sacrifices? Now, the answer we might hope to that is, well, actually, there won't be any sacrifices if we're faithful enough. But of course, we know that that's not the truth. Sacrifices will be required. But actually, there's so much more that comes with following God that makes those sacrifices worthwhile. And if we're ever tempted to listen to those who preach a gospel that says, if only you had more faith, then you would be rich, then know that that is simply untrue. So here we have a psalm, the first half of which pulls very few punches and asks the sort of difficult questions that perhaps we've all thought in our time. And if we look at which psalm it is, then perhaps this isn't surprising. This is Psalm number 73, which means that it's the first psalm of Book 3 within the Book of Psalms. Book of Psalms is divided into five books, and although, of course, the experts can't quite decide on why that might be the case, they do agree on some things. So some of them say that, well, actually, it was just they wanted to divide it into five so that it was like the first five books of the Old Testament. Moses had five books of the law, so they wanted David to have five books of poetry. I'm not quite sure whether I buy that or not. I think what's perhaps more persuasive is that when they put the collection together, they brought collections that had been written at different times of their history and that were already out there as collections of poetry. And so books one and two were mainly written at a time when David or his immediate successors were on the throne, when the first temple was standing, and basically when times were reasonably good for the people of God. Yes, they describe the struggles that they had. They describe events in David's lifetime. But they come from that period of relative stability. Book 3, which we now enter at Psalm 73, is different. Most of them were written at a time of great struggle and great doubt. Either when the people had been exiled, when Jerusalem had been overrun and they'd been taken off to Babylon, or possibly when they were back, but reflecting on that experience. A time when things may have seemed hopeless. A time when it was natural to say, why has this happened to us when we thought we were the people of God? Why do others seem to have it so much better than us? But as we've thought about already, that's a dangerous path to go down. Unfortunately, that's not the whole of the psalm. This is a psalm of two halves, and the second half begins with the words that suggest that, yes, there is a different way of looking at things. Indeed, the first half, verse 2, had begun with the phrase, I almost slipped. In other words, thankfully, he didn't. And he explains why. As verses 16 to 28 answer the complaints of verses 2 to 14. And one thing happens that helps him regain the proper perspective. He says that he struggled, and in verse 17, until I entered the sanctuary of God. And that's where he found some of the answers he was looking for, or perhaps more correctly, found the right perspective to look at the questions he was asking. And again, if we do a little bit of digging, we perhaps begin to understand why that might be the case. If you notice the little words at the start of Psalm 73, even before verse 1, it says that it is a psalm of Asaph. And we don't know much about him, but we do know that he was a musician, a worship leader in David's temple. And he probably didn't write this psalm, but it may well have been written by his descendants, either literally his descendants or those who had followed in the role that he took in the temple. In other words, people who knew what it was like to be a worshipping people. People who knew what it was like to be constantly in God's presence. God is always with us. But sometimes we have to be deliberate in making sure that we know that, making sure that we find the space to listen, making sure that we understand that he is there with us. And so Asaph and those who followed him had found that spending time in the temple reminded them that this was the eternal God. This was the Almighty God. This was the God who created everything. This was the God who was the liberator, who freed his people from Egypt. In other words, they got the big picture, and they showed the real worth of the things that they'd been getting all uptight about. Let me just pause for a minute and tell you a little story, which I hope I haven't told you before, but if I have, I don't really apologize, because I think it's relevant to what we're talking about this morning. It's about a man called Robert Cummings, who was an esteemed and respected art critic. And one day he found himself in a gallery in London, very excited because he was going to see a picture by a 15th century master called Filippino Lippi that was very rarely on public viewing. And so he was excited to see it. It was a picture of Mary holding the baby Jesus, and on either side were the saints, St. Dominic and St. Jerome. And so he went, and he stood there, and he looked. And he could see that the colours, although a little bit faded over time, had obviously been perfect in their composition and had been amazing originally. He could still see that the brushwork was exquisite. But he looked at the painting and he thought, actually, I'm not sure it's quite right. I know it's supposed to be a masterpiece, but why are those hills that should be in the background so prominent? Why do the two saints look slightly wrong? And why does everything look quite lifeless? Even Mary looks to be staring blankly into space. And he had this somewhat heretical thought that this picture, which was supposed to be a masterpiece, actually maybe wasn't very good. But then he had his light bulb moment. And in the middle of this gallery, this very respectable man suddenly sank to his knees, because he had realized that this painting was never supposed to be on the wall of a gallery being looked at eye level. It had been painted to go above a communion table, to be viewed by people who were kneeling to receive. And when he did so, when he looked at it from that angle, suddenly everything changed. The hills receded into the background where they should be. The painting of the two saints looked perfect. And Mary wasn't looking blankly into space, but was looking directly at him, inviting him to worship with them. He understood the importance of perspective, and we need to understand it as well. We need to seek out the true perspective. We need to be intentional about coming closer to God. Perhaps by coming regularly to a place like this that is soaked in generations of worship and of prayer. Maybe by committing ourselves afresh to a time of daily prayer and Bible reading. Maybe by joining a life group or working with other Christians, serving others. And perhaps it will happen today, as we enter into communion with our Christian sisters and brothers and share the sacrament together. And as Ray leads us, he will help us relive the ancient narrative that is central to our story. The narrative of what Jesus has done and continues to do for each one of us. The narrative that tells us why we can say that we are God's children. Why we can know that we're part of his story. It'll help give us a bigger perspective than we normally have. And like Asaph in Psalm 73, we'll begin to see the eternal story, and indeed see the eternal story of those that we've previously envied. That's the same thing that was happening in our gospel reading, when Jesus answered the queries about why good crops and weeds were allowed to grow up together, and explained that a short-term apparent unfairness would be dealt with in God's timescale, not our own timescale that we might hope for. And that indeed, in doing so, it would be for our benefit. An eternal perspective helps us realize that present realities are not necessarily what they seem. Luxury is always a relative concept. And people who have a lot often never seem to think they have enough. People who think that happiness can be bought are usually disappointed. Even when their midlife crisis is addressed by buying a motorbike or a Maserati, they find that they still have that empty feeling. And perhaps people in public might seem that they have no worries at all. But when they go home and they're on their own, there can be much private angst instead. There are few places lonelier than a big house when no one else is there. And perhaps our eternal perspective might even help us believe that whatever hardships we might face could be part of bringing us life in all its fullness. Through them, we might find a sense of worth. Through them, we might find people who we think have much less than us, but actually end up blessing us enormously. We need to read this psalm and make sure that we read both halves of it, not just wallow in the complaints of the first half. And we also need to notice that there's another little thing going on. Those of you who were busy counting the numbers of the verses will know that I miss one out when I compare the two halves. Verse 15 comes between them and is pivotal to the whole psalm. And it explains that the negative thoughts that might come and are described in the first half of the psalm are a danger not just to us, but to other people as well, because we have a responsibility as the people of God towards other people. Each generation needs to learn what is truly real, not just what they are told is reality by TV, by social media, by everything that's out there. It's up to us to tell them what the real true story is. We're doing them a huge disservice if we get sucked in and grumble about the same things that they do. If we seem to confirm that the version of reality described in the first half of this psalm is true. We must make sure that we don't end up complaining, saying that their life seems nicer than ours, because that simply isn't the truth. We have to show and tell them the good news. Unfortunately, the psalmist understood this. He describes the problem in verse 15, but he answers it at the very end of the psalm when he says that he will tell of God's good deeds. Indeed, the end of the psalm echoes its beginning and acknowledges that God is indeed good to his beloved children. Yes, we might forget that occasionally. Yes, we might need to actively ensure that we are reminded. We need to make sure that we always remember that truth, and we should be proud to make it known. Amen.